This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We're diving back into one of the hottest cases that there is, the Karen Reed case. Judge Beverly Cannone, depending on who you ask, she's either keeping the trial fair and focused, or she's the fourth prosecutor hiding in plain sight. Supporters of Karen Reed say that she's biased, censoring the defense, and protecting the so-called Canton cover-up. Critics claim that she's overstepping, silencing protests, and limiting what the jury gets to hear. On the flip side, others argue that she's just following the rule of law. She's cool-headed in a courtroom that's turned into a reality show with a true crime Twitter subplot. Joining us to discuss, someone who knows both sides of the courtroom, former prosecutor and defense attorney, Eric Fattis. Eric, let's start here. When a judge begins limiting suspects, excluding expert witnesses, and blocking an attorney from joining the defense team, it sounds pretty bad on the surface, but when you dig into the reasoning behind these choices, to me it makes a little bit more sense from a legal standpoint. What are your thoughts?
You know, the common understanding is a person gets their day in court, right? And so some people think that that means they get to go in there and say whatever they want and call whatever witnesses they want and do whatever they want. But that's not the reality inside that courtroom. Inside that courtroom, there are rules. And oftentimes, witnesses are limited. Defenses are limited. Attorneys can be limited. That one's a little less common. But by and large, those types of rulings are something that are rather common.
And a lot of these rulings that we're talking about here, in this case, there's been several that she's been looking at. One of them was the attorney that they wanted to bring in. The name eludes me at this moment in time. There was another one that they were trying to bring in other than just the juror. And then you also have the issue of potential witnesses, the potential third party culprit that they were trying to go after, Colin Elbert being one of them, the teen that they say was part of this conspiracy. And it does play a big role in their defense. At least it certainly did in the last one. What's your thoughts on that, on limiting who can and can't come in, and why the judge would make that decision? And what is the bar for allowing some of these theories to play in and allowing people to become witnesses?
Tony, what we're talking about is an alternative suspect theory. And so, you know, defense oftentimes in a case like this, they want to point the finger at one or multiple people to kind of give the impression of reasonable doubt in terms of who did this. Here, in order to present such a defense, usually you need what's called a non-speculative connection between the third party and the allegations it charged. And so, you know, you can't just say, could have been this guy or possibly him. You have to sort of be able to draw a line, a direct connection between Colin Elbert and and what happened. And the judge is saying, hey, there's not enough there to do that. Although I do understand the judge is allowing defense to argue alternative suspects for two other individuals. I think Brian Higgins and perhaps the other name escapes her.
Yeah. Why? I guess if you're going to pull, the kid out, which makes sense because I think it's a ridiculous theory. If you just look at the facts and you look at evidence, I mean, they're trying to hang their hat on with the Colin Elbert is the Knuckles photo, where there's a photo of him actually right after the death of John O'Keefe and his knuckles are fine. And then a couple weeks later, there's one where they're scraped up, but they certainly do not look like they were in a fight unless John O'Keefe was made out of concrete. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So I get that. And the fact that he's a kid, and why on earth would he have any reason to kill an officer or be part of a conspiracy? But why the other two? Why are they allowing that in when, I don't know, on the surface, it feels like it's just as an insane argument.
My hunch is that the other two are at least more intimately involved in the series of events that lead up to John O'Keefe's death. For example, Brian Higgins was at the bar. Mm-hmm. He was talking with Karen Reed. He was talking with John O'Keefe. Defense is going to try to spin that into some sort of nefarious involvement once they got back to the Albert's house. Mm-hmm. Whereas Colin Albert, the kid, he wasn't present for any of these things that led up to and gave rise to John O'Keefe's death. And so I think perhaps they're just saying that, hey, these other two have enough direct involvement, even though I did see the judge had mentioned that there is still sort of scant evidence of alternative suspect for Brian Higgins and the other person, but enough to meet the bar, whereas for the kid Albert, not enough.
They did the internal investigation, or not internally, an external investigation into their into the department of how they handled the case. Came out, yeah, sloppy police work, without a doubt, and a lot of missteps there. But no conspiracy. No. They didn't find anything that shows that they were trying to frame Karen Reed. That's what it came out to be. The defense wanted to have an FBI expert come in and give some context to it and ask him what he thought of how the case went and how the investigation went. Judge Cannone said, basically, look, the jury can make their own decision based on all the witnesses you're going to call. They can make their conclusion. Was that a fair move to say that you can't have the expert or the former FBI agent come in and give some insight and basically kind of hold their hand and walk them through that? We see it in other cases sometimes where an expert comes in to help define evidence and what's going on. And this would be kind of defining what was in those findings. What's your thoughts on that ruling?
You know, actually a pretty common ruling, especially in Colorado where I practice. In order to call an expert, they have to be talking about expert stuff, which means information that is outside the purview of a normal juror's understanding. You know, a normal juror can say whether a person engaged in self-defense, but they can't necessarily say like how digital forensics were investigated, something like that. And so what the judge is saying is like, hey, the jury can decide if this was shoddy police work or not. Any lay person is capable of doing that. It's not expert testimony, according to the judge. That's a common ruling that we see. Now, for example, if this was a use of force case with police, then you're getting more likely to have an expert talk about police standards and whether they were met. But those issues are not germane to whether Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe with her car.
Let's talk about the other issue. We were kind of touching on it earlier. The Mark Bedreau, who's representing the blogger, and they wanted to bring him in. That's the other attorney that they wanted to bring in. Obviously, representing both people does present a bit of a conflict of interest because it could benefit or it could hurt either side, depending on what comes in. What's your thoughts on that? You had some attorney. I mean, obviously, the rest of her legal counsel thought it was a good idea. I mean, these are not dumb attorneys. They're very, very experienced, and they thought it was good. Karen Reed signed off on it. The blogger signed off on it. The judge said no. Was that a wise decision, a fair decision to prevent there being any sort of conflict of interest down the road?
You know, a defendant's choice of counsel is usually a pretty important choice that has to be recognized. Here, I think the judge was balancing three considerations. One is that there is a possible conflict of interest. The judge has to make sure that conflict doesn't occur because it could result in a reversal down the road. Additionally, this case has been dragging on for quite some time. We're at the second trial, and perhaps a new attorney might stall things. There have been delays requested by defense before, and perhaps the judge foresaw something like that and wanted to eliminate that. On top of that, you know, just the defense already has a lot of attorneys. And so one more, you know, might be seen as cumulative and unnecessary. And the judge, I think, is saying, hey, we got to get this thing tried. We got to get some finality. And I'm worried that those considerations might impair our ability to do that.
Seems like there's a lot of issues here regarding the gag order on this case. Every time I go to Twitter, there's Karen saying something. The gag order. Does that simply apply to the attorneys of Karen Reed, or is Karen free to speak to anyone that she wants?
Typically, it applies to the attorneys and the parties.
Yeah.
And Karen is a party. She's a defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we saw in the Trump legal matters that gag orders can come up against a person's right to free speech. And that analysis is pretty complicated and would happen at the appellate level down the road. So although the gag order would apply to Karen Reed, she may have been advised that she has a First Amendment right to speak anyway, and she might be kind of testing the waters and pushing the envelope there in hopes the judge doesn't shut her down.
I saw a clip this morning of her eating a bag of chips and talking to people. It was really weird. It's like, put the bag of chips down, Karen. The reporters have microphones by you and you're answering their questions. It's just like, and then her attorneys are on the steps like, get up here. It's like, I'm sorry, my attorneys are calling me because she happened to slip up and say that nobody's being paid. That's an interesting angle here because she's getting all sorts of money from people. The support Karen Reed, the defense fund, all of that. Again, you've got a fundraise, you got costs usually for something like this, but the amount that she's raised, that's a lot of pantsuits for what she's gotten. Is there any issue with that, where you're raising money for your defense, but your defense is doing this pro bono? What the hell's going on with all of that? And does that raise a potential issue down the road? I mean, is that fraud? If you're saying you're going to get this money and you're going to be using it on that, it's certainly, you know, there's only so many hotel rooms you're going to have to pay for. There's only so many realistic expenses that you could say, well, yes, I'm not paying them that, but I'm using it over here for these expenses. It doesn't quite add up to that if you kind of do the math.
There are multiple concerns. One is that from the prosecution standpoint, Karen Reed is kind of enriching herself,
yes,
by taking this generously donated money and not using it for the cause that she kind of said she would use it for. And that gives rise to a potential legal issue, like you said, of fraudulent conduct, or at the very least of some level of deception that the government might try to use against her. If her words come in to evidence at the behest of the defense, the prosecution can put on rebuttal evidence of her being deceptive because it goes to her credibility.
Would that be a whole other case? Would that not be this murder trial? Could there be a follow-up to this thing where it's some sort of fraud trial that could be brought against her?
Oh gosh, you know, it's not separate and apart from like charity fraud. That sort of thing happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, and so, you know, folks can be separately charged in that instance. She could be separately charged in this instance.
Yeah. I find it very bizarre. How difficult would it be to defend Karen Reed? Just considering how, I guess, loose of a cannon she seems to be, or lack of candor, or lack of knowing when to shut up, that seems to be quite a difficulty for her, not only from the dock, but again, every time she's on the court steps and mics go in front of her, she just can't seem to help herself and to speak into them and say incriminating things about herself without seeming to even understand it.
In the criminal defense world, we often talk about client control. And what that means is sort of protecting your client from themselves, from them doing something that could substantially harm their case. But when you have a client who is kind of headstrong, who at least by some accounts sort of seeks out media attention, that kind of thing, and then on top of that, who doesn't present terribly well in the public eye, that's a recipe for disaster, and it can be terribly frustrating for a defense attorney.
And it feels like initially, you know, she presented okay the first round. I mean, meeting people thought she was hot, and that's about it. Nobody really knew a whole lot more. But now that we've gotten to see the real Karen, more than just a single Dateline episode or anything, and we've seen her outlook, her lack of empathy for the victims' families, for these kids that have been harassed that have absolutely nothing to do with this case, It's been pretty shocking. And now that we're also seeing pretty damn clear evidence that looks like collusion, not been charged yet. But I mean, come on, when we're talking about her having 40 plus hours talking to the blogger, and we know what was the context of these conversations, where are we going there? Do you think we're going to see charges here of collusion at some point? Could that happen during jury selection, which is going on as of this recording? Could it come during the trial? Could it happen after the trial? And how serious could that be for Karen Reed and possibly even her attorneys, especially when we looked at some of those texts, strings back and forth between the blogger and them. It seems they were pretty on board with witness intimidation, at the very least. That's my conjecture. Again, no charges there yet, but, you know, you can read and go, this doesn't look very good.
There is surely a legal concern about witness intimidation and whether that can be tied to Karen Reed and or her attorneys. And in my appraisal, the government, if they did bring charges, they would probably have to do it after the trial because they would need to establish that the witnesses were, in fact, intimidated. And the way you usually establish that is if a witness fails to appear or if a witness gets on the stand and testifies under oath that, hey, I'm super scared to be here and I'm really worried for my safety based on what this side was doing to me, but I'm here. I think the government would be prudent to wait and see what happens with those witnesses at the trial before they brought such charges, but not out of the realm of possibility.
Would that be an interesting move for those witnesses not to appear? What sort of consequences could they face if they say, I'm not going because I fear for my safety? And I think it's a very legitimate concern, considering how vile some of these people are. If I were a witness and I had nothing to do with this and I'm being accused of something heinous, and you have this rabid pack of people out there with pink shirts that want to crucify you, yeah, I think I'm going to sit that out and let the courts do whatever they want to do. Want to put me away for a week or whatever? That'd be an interesting move against Karen if these witnesses just say, screw it, we do not feel safe enough to show up. What would happen if they play that?
If that happened, that could cause significant disarray in the trial. Both sides are anticipating that these witnesses are going to be there. They're planning for what the testimony will be and how to finesse it. If a witness fails to appear and they have been properly served with a subpoena, the side that served them could ask the judge to issue an arrest warrant for that witness. And usually what happens is law enforcement goes out and arrests that person, puts them in jail, transports them from jail directly to the courthouse and forces them to testify. If they still choose not to testify verbally on the stand, they could be held in contempt. So there are very serious ramifications for a witness who does not testify, even if they have a really good reason, like they're scared for their safety.
Interesting. What kind of ramifications would that be, I guess? Because I think that'd be something you'd weigh if you're that witness going, I'll deal with it. Like, it's I'd rather take the consequences over here than take the consequence of possibly being killed by one of these rabid people when they lose their mind if she's convicted or something.
Hey, Tony, that happens in gang cases all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time, witnesses are concerned about testifying against alleged gang members and that kind of thing, and they choose not to appear on their subpoenas. They're oftentimes arrested, brought into court, and in those circumstances, they choose on the stand to say, hey, I'm not saying anything, screw you guys. And what happens from there is the judge could find them in direct contempt, and usually in most jurisdictions can sentence that witness up to 90 days in jail. So they are running some serious risks if they choose not to comply with those court orders.
90 days in jail versus possibly being killed? I'd take the 90 days.
You got to weigh it.
I mean, and if you were to do that, I mean, could that shut the whole trial down? Like, if a lot of these witnesses just said, screw it, I'm not going to show up. I mean, would that immediately get into witness intimidation territory, or would the trial just continue to go on and then the witness intimidation issue would be second thought after a verdict is rendered or however this case is decided?
It could substantially impact the trial, in part because if a witness is properly served and for whatever reason they are not able, they don't testify, that side could ask for a mistrial. They could say, hey, we expected this witness to comply with the law. They didn't. It was a big part of our case. We got to do a do-over. And so then we'd be on Karen Reed trial round three. And I think any witness intimidation matters would be brought after that second possible mistrial.
That's a lot of ways this could go. Do you foresee any issues here with this thing getting off the ground? I mean, with there's so many things that do feel to be up in the air here. The issues with the blogger, the issues with possible witness intimidation. There's just so many things that could go wrong, it seems, before this thing even gets off the ground. Just from a legal standpoint, from your experience, do you think we're going to get into this trial and it's going to go through as planned, or is something going to break this up before it actually gets going?
You know, a lot of volatility with this case, a lot of moving parts, a lot of things that could go wrong. We just talked about witnesses possibly choosing not to testify. Mm-hmm. You know, that being said, I think Judge Cannone is pretty darn dedicated to getting this thing to some final conclusion. And she has invested time and court resources and everything else, all the attorneys have and parties as well. And so I think we're going to reach some kind of conclusion. Now, that could be another mistrial by a hung jury, but I think we're going to get to the jury deliberation phase absent some extraordinary thing.
Had the defense of Karen Reed not gone down the third-party culprit route, and I found it very interesting, and I'm sure there's probably more to the story because in a documentary you just get little nuggets, but from what we understood in the doc that came out the other week, the whole reason they went down the third-party road was because of a spooky, weird individual that came up and said, you better look at the people in that house. And if you already feel like the local authorities are bending the rules quite a bit, yeah, I could see any citizen saying, look a little closer over there. I'm not saying I know anything, but look a little closer over there. And they did. But, I mean, they didn't find anything. They kind of made up a narrative. That was a weird part to me of nobody came to them with evidence saying they beat him up. This happened. And this, it was just look closer. And then the attorneys came up with this story. How do you do that? How do you just come up with a narrative that doesn't really have any evidence to support it? And you're just kind of like grabbing things here and there that say, oh, this might be part of it, maybe. But there's really, I don't know, there's not a lot there to support the whole third party. He got beat up in the house story. To this day, I don't quite understand how they went down that road or why they went down that road. And if it was a wise idea, I would almost wonder if she would be a free woman today had they not done that.
I thought that alleged anonymous tip was kind of curious too. You know, they don't disclose who it was. And, mm-hmm. and with modern investigation, you can ping a phone, which oftentimes can show its location. You can sometimes investigate IP addresses, and if it's a landline, you can oftentimes identify that. So there are ways to find out who that person was and find out why they said that. What background information did they have? Did they have some kind of evidence? Well, I didn't see any such person called at the trial.
No.
And so was this something that sort of just gave an impetus to defense to be off to the races with this alternative suspect theory? Very well could be. And there hasn't been a lot of witness statements in my appraisal that have supported them.
Well, the fact that this was said, that this person exists by one of Karen Reed's attorneys, and it's been said publicly, obviously, would they have to have record of who the hell that was? I mean, could the prosecution go and try and subpoena that person? Would it have to be revealed who came and gave this magical tip, considering it's now like the impetus of their case, and get that person on the stand and go, okay, you stated this, that's fine, but why? What was your reasoning for it? And if it comes out, well, my gut tells me they're shady cops. And that's the end of the story. So you didn't like have this whole theory that like he got beat up and killed. And, like that's all. No, that's what the attorneys came up with. That might not look very good.
Oh, I hear you. And the thing is, the general rule is defense does not have to disclose that. They do not have to disclose defense investigation. Now, if the shoe were on the other foot mm-hmm. and the prosecution received such a tip, you better believe the prosecution would be legally required to disclose all of the information and details regarding that tip and the identity of the person who gave it if they could determine that. But defense doesn't have to do that. And that's kind of a... some might say like a sly move from defense saying, hey, there's this sort of phantom person and they said some suspicious stuff. And now we have this whole alternative suspect defense.
It's weird. That seems like somewhat of a double standard. And I know we're talking about the rules, basically. But so it basically states one side can make things up. completely out of thin air. Who knows if this person even exists? Because they don't have to prove he exists. They don't have to prove that this even happened. They can just say it happened. But on the other side, if they were to say, well, we got a tip that says this, and they'd have to produce that, why? Why the double standard on something like this? Why can one side just make things up out of thin air and sell it really good to a jury? And the other side, they could probably sell it really good to a jury, too, if they could make random facts up.
One reason is rooted in the Constitution. And so the Constitution essentially says that it applies to the government. So it applies to the government's actions. They have to provide due process. They have to provide a fair trial. They have to ensure that those rights are not violated. And part of that, the courts have decided, is disclosing inculpatory and incriminating and relevant evidence to the defense, so the defense is not caught off guard. Constitution doesn't apply to the defense. And so they don't have the same obligation, and they don't have the same legal authority that requires that obligation.
Interesting. Huh. I think they're using that to their advantage there a little bit, which, I mean, hey, you're playing by the rules that you are given, and that's what you can do. It's going to be fascinating. God knows what we'll be talking about next week when we get into this case, because it changes by the minute. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, thank you so much for joining us.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.